Call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. The quorum is present. First order of business would be approval of the minutes from April 6th. Chair would entertain a motion to that effect.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Actually, Representative Bryant, Representative Johnson beat you to it. We have to recognize people clear down at the end of the table once in a while. Motion for the approval of the minutes is before us. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Members, first on the agenda today is House File 1744, which is my bill, which was heard in the Government Operations Committee to basically consider the policy involved. It has been heard also in state government finance. There were time constraints in both government operations and state government finance that caused us not to be able to entertain testimony from some of the interested parties who really did want to have testimony on the record, and I said that I would give them the opportunity to do that at the beginning of this hearing. And so before I turn the gavel over to Representative Falk, we will take the testimony from advocates for the bill. We have Jamie Taylor and Steve Jacobson at the table. If whichever one of you would want to begin, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to start. My name is Jamie Taylor, and I'm the Access and Technology Specialist with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. I'm going to give a very brief overview of Section 508 and WCAG, or Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. Section 508 is a portion of federal law that requires that federal employees and members of the community with disabilities have the same access to and use of federal data and information that people with disabilities, people in the community and federal employees without disabilities have, unless it would cause what is called an undue burden financially. WCAG, however, was written by and created by the World Wide Web Consortium, or the W3C, which is the main international standards organization for the World Wide Web. 508 and WCAG are very compatible with each other, but WCAG deals strictly with the World Wide Web and has more detailed guidelines. There's three levels of accessibility in the WCAG: A, AA, and AAA. The requested funds in this bill will provide access funds for accessibility testing at and piloting at the AA and AAA levels, which are the higher levels of accessibility. The committee will then get together and write recommendations on which level provides the highest level and how to do it without creating an undue burden to the state. The Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans contacted 18 other states. Inside your packet today, you'll find Oklahoma's response. Oklahoma is considered the gold standard for accessibility in the United States. They said, one, that their committee, there's no fiscal note for their committee, advisory committee. Two, that they know of no state agencies in Oklahoma that pay hired full-time employees to implement the standards. 3 that their state actually saved money because they didn't have to retrofit purchase software. Thank you for letting me to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Representative Hilty, and members of the committee. My name is Steve Jacobson. I'm the Vice President of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, and I also serve as the Vice President of our nationwide computer science group. And I've been a computer analyst in private industry for 30 years now. I'd like to kind of approach this from a slightly different angle. I think most members of the committee and others hearing this testimony understand how this legislation or this language would help persons who have disabilities and who are blind be more effective on the job, and even state employees who are disabled, who are already employees, will benefit from this. I'd like to talk a little bit about how it benefits the state of Minnesota, what it means to plan accessibility into software and websites as opposed to having to react to it. It needs to be understood first what we're asking for in this law in terms of software and hardware and so forth. We are not asking for talking computers or braille printers or anything along those lines there. What we are asking is that the software that the state of Minnesota purchases or develops is compatible with technology that we already use. For example, blind persons now commonly use Windows XP, Vista, Microsoft Word and Excel, Internet Explorer, Firefox, and countless other applications that each of you use every day. Some hardware manufacturers like Lexmark and Hewlett-Packard have started to work with us to make some of their devices, multifunction printer, copier, faxes, and so forth, more accessible. If we plan accessibility into the purchasing of state government, private industry knows that their products must be accessible to blind persons to be considered for purchase by government, more companies will do this kind of planning and build it into their product development cycles, making purchasing of software and hardware that is accessible even easier than it is now. So planning would be a big help in that respect. What if accessibility is not part of the planning process? The chances are very good that the Americans with Disability Act and other state and federal laws and regulations could be interpreted to require that in the future the state have to retrofit systems and repurchase technologies. Having been involved in such cases myself, recently with Target, for example, I've seen close up that even though I may not have had a lot of sympathy for Target, it is a real burden for them to have to hire programmers and lawyers at the same time to deal with a court decision. The costs of planning for accessibility are far less than having to react to it. And this is something that just cannot be emphasized too much. The planning is not that difficult. The reacting can be very bad, can lead to expensive solutions that are less effective. The importance of accessibility in the world of technology today is much more important than it was and visible than it was 10 years ago when the first access to technology laws were brought into play. Standards and paths are now clearer to follow, and there are federal guidelines, as Jamie mentioned, that can be leveraged. If access to technology purchased by the state of Minnesota and access to that technology is planned for, the costs will be far lower than would be the case if the state has to respond to other ADA violations and other laws that may be violated that are not known until after the fact. In addition, many of us will find employment as taxpayers. The effect of this approach will also affect jobs in the private sector who use much of the same technology and hardware. Please support this bill and thank you for your attention.
Are there any questions for either of the witnesses? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Representative Hilty, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. I would move that House Bill 1744 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Members, as you're aware, House Bill 1744 is a bill that would require going forward that the state and its official websites and other publicly accessible materials provide captioning that would accommodate the needs of various kinds of disabilities. The reason that the bill is before us here is that the funding for the bill, which you will find at the very end in section 15, is from an account that is under the purview of this division, which is the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund. It's commonly known as the TAM fund, and it appropriates for the implementation of the bill $300,000 in fiscal year 2010 and $300,000 in fiscal year 2011. And that is a one-time appropriation. You will probably hear from Ms. Wells from the Department of Commerce that this is an inappropriate use of the Telecommunications Access Fund. Representative Westrum and I think, have contemplated that argument and come to a different conclusion. There is a handout in your packet that describes why we think that it is, in fact, an appropriate source of funding for this purpose. And there's also in your packet a handout describing the testimony for Representative Westrum. Representative Westrum, of course, is not able to be with us today because of the recent blessed event in the family. And I'm kind of disappointed that he is not able to be here because he did testify on behalf of this bill in government operations, and it was, I believe, quite a compelling testimony. Since we're not really here to discuss the policy of the bill, but rather just the funding source, I think I will leave it at that. I have with me at the table Mary Hartnett, who is the director of the Commission on Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing in the state of Minnesota, who is one of the advocates for the bill and is available to answer questions if members have any. And with that, we will stand for questions.
Ms. Hartnett, did you have any testimony you wish to offer or just to take questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if the members have questions, we did include in your packet talking points as to why we feel it's appropriate use of the funds. I could quickly go through those. telecommunication projects are covered under the standards that we have proposed in this legislation, Section 508 of the Federal Rehabilitation Act. It includes information technology and its definition, telecommunication projects, products which are included in the TAM legislation. Mr. Jacobson has already talked about risk management. A $6 million settlement was between National Federation for the Blind and Target Corporation was settled last year for $6 million because of the lack of access accessibility with websites. The National Federation for the Blind has also lodged lawsuits against the state of Texas and the state of New York in the last year because states have not been responsive to consumers' requests for accessibility of state equipment, state information being available to members of the public with disabilities and without disabilities being on the same par. So it's a trend that's happening, and we want to nip it in the bud. And I think that the time is now. We've been working for 2 years to try to get these standards adopted on a voluntary basis, and the only alternative advocates saw was to move forward with legislation. Minnesota already uses funds for captioning, which is part of the use of the funds for legislative sessions that are live streamed on the web, for those to be captioned and for pilots to be provided with live captioning, find the most cost-effective means of doing that. And there is a portion of the current TAMP funding that is allocated to and dedicated to captioning for news news broadcasts. Other states are supporting their 508 and implementation of their 508 standards. South Carolina is using their funds for this purpose. And the bill, I believe, supports the original intent of the TAM law, which was to make telecommunications accessible. It extends the definition but still provides access to communication that the tax was intended to give at times through the phone and times through the Internet.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Hilty.
I should have mentioned, I think members have in the packets also a preliminary fiscal note which suggests a quite considerable cost to the Office of Enterprise Technology. I had conversations earlier today with Mr. Lally from OET, who acknowledges that this fiscal note is based on an earlier version of the bill, which seemed to imply, although it was never our intent, that existing equipment, hardware, and software would need to be replaced in order to comply with the requirements of the bill. That is not the case. The bill in its before us in the second engrossment does not have that requirement, and I think that all parties are in agreement at this time that the funding provided in the bill is sufficient to cover the cost as they currently would be incurred by the requirements of the bill.
Ms. Hartman?
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is also the deed has also said that they would be willing to dedicate some of the ARRA funds, the stimulus dollars, to help with the implementation of this.
Further questions for this testifier? Representative Norton or Anderson, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Harnett, you mentioned something about lawsuits that were being filed against other states. Do you know the specifics of why those, is it because of funding or is it because of other technicalities that are being looked at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I believe the lawsuit in both, and actually Mr. Jacobson could speak to those as a member of the National Federation of the Blind, the previous testifier that we had, but I believe both occurred because employees were unable to do their jobs. Because equipment was purchased that they were not able to use, that they had been longtime employees within the state, and equipment was purchased that made them unable to do their jobs. And no changes were made, and then they sued to make sure that the accommodations were made.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Current language in the law calls for best value bidding. Is this going to increase the cost?
Ms. Hartman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, there's an undue burden clause that is within 508, but which we've been negotiating with the Office of Enterprise Technology and with the Department of Administration, and we've added into, and we'll have an amendment coming forward, I believe, in the Finance Committee when this is heard in Finance, that will address that. But we've made it very clear that if there is an undue burden to the state, that there will be deviations from the standard. We don't want this to cause an undue burden to the state. An undue burden is defined as technically not feasible or excessive cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Thank you. Anybody else wish to testify on behalf of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I believe Ms. Wells was hoping to testify.
Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hilke. My name is Diane Wells, and I'm the manager of the Telecommunications Division within the Department of Commerce, and my purpose for being here today is limited solely to Section 15 of the bill, which allocates $300,000 per year from the TAM Fund, which is administered by the Department of Commerce. The TAM Fund was established in 1987 for the purpose of providing access to the telephone network for people who are deaf, hard of hearing, speech disabled, or physically disabled. This is done by providing devices to enable the use of a telephone and or the relay service to facilitate communications between communications-impaired and non-communications-impaired persons. The TAM program is supported by a 6-cent per month surcharge assessed against every landline and wireless telephone in Minnesota. So it is funded by telephone ratepayers in the state of Minnesota, not broadband or internet customers. And when the fund was established, it was determined to be fair to assist telephone ratepayers because if a communications-impaired person isn't able to use the telephone network, they'll subscribe to telephone service, and they'll be able to call me, and I'll be able to call them, so the network is more valuable to telephone subscribers. The TAM program and budget is administered within the Department of Commerce, and in the TAM program, we oversee the relay and the equipment portions of the program. The other parts that are funded by TAM, the accessible news for the blind, the CAPS news for the out-state networks, and the money that funds the Commission for the Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing are just direct transfers out of that account. We have no oversight over those programs. As the overseer of that fund, my purpose in being here today is because we believe it is our responsibility to alert you when there are proposals, such as in Section 15 of House File 1744, that we believe would appropriate TAM funds for uses not intended when the program was established and that go astray of the intent of the TAM program, which, as I stated, is to facilitate use of the telephone by communications-impaired persons. I would also like to add that, as you are aware, this bill was not a part of the governor's budget recommendation. Thank you for the opportunity to express the department's concerns, and I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you might have.
Questions from Ms. Wells? Representative Jackson?
For a testifier, I'm wondering if you can give me a sort of ballpark amount of money that comes in every year and what goes out every year and what sort of fund balance the TAM Fund currently has.
Ms. Wells?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jackson, the TAM Fund, find another sheet. For the biennium, we have $600,000 for the Commission for Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing, $200,000 for the Accessible News Program, which is where a person that can't read a newspaper can pick up the phone and have a newspaper read to them, and $600,000 for the Rural Closed Captioning, which is for the non-network affiliated outstate TV stations. Closed captioning is paid for out of the fund. The administration of the TAM program is just under $800,000. The relay service is $6 million, and then the equipment distribution is $4 million. And the appropriation in this bill would be $300,000 a year or $600,000. So the fee is 6 cents per month now. If we weren't funding the non-TAM programs, it would be 5 cents a month per telephone or cellular phone. And our projection is it'll have to go up to 7 cents next July if this bill passes. And the fund balance, roughly at the beginning of the fiscal year, there is about $2 million into it because the payments out are kind of lumpy. Right away in July, there's $700,000 that are paid out to the non-TAM program. And then there's the TAM program expenses are about monthly about $450,000. And so we try to keep about 2 months' worth of funding in the fund at any given time. And so the lowest point is in July after those direct transfers are made out. And it is, the fund is by landline telephone and wireless. I have a meeting scheduled with public safety. They do the collection because they have the 911 piece of it. And there are some issues being raised. The VoIP phone services are, in some cases, not paying the fee. They say they don't have to because they're not a telephone. And the prepaid wireless aren't paying the fees. So, you know, we're looking at long-term projections, and it's not a real stable source right now. There are going to have to be some changes that are made, and we're working with Public Safety and the Public Utilities Commission to determine how best to address those.
Representative Jackson.
Well, thanks for that information. On average, what is the net after you've paid your expenses for a given year, realizing that there's a high point in January and a low point in July?
Ms. Wells.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jackson, I guess because the expenses are lumpy, we have to target July when there's the most drawdown on the account, so we have to have enough money in the account at that point. So at the beginning of the fiscal year, it's about $2 million, like I said. If this bill passes, we'll be drawn down to $125,000, which is only about a little more than a fourth of what we need for the monthly expenses related to the TAM program. So it's not really, you're not really able to look at it. It's like property taxes are due in May. Well, as a an owner of a home, I can't say, oh, this month I have that big bill I have to pay out of whatever. I have to put money away each month in order to pay that, and that's somewhat the way we run the TAM program. So we have the money there when the expenses are due.
Further questions? Anyone else wish to testify on behalf of the bill? Representative Hilty, would you like to renew your motion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would, and I respect Ms. Wells' diligence and the position that she is more or less required to take, but I would submit to the members that probably asking people to spend an additional 12 cents per year in order to make government information accessible to every citizen in the state is probably worth it. So I would renew my motion, Mr. Chair, that the House File 1744, second engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Representative Hilty renews its motion that House File 1744, the second engrossment, be recommended to pass and return to Finance. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed to Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bly, continue our discussion of House File 932. Thank you. Representative Bly, did you have any remarks that you wanted to make initially, or should we just go to the testifiers? I know we have a long list of people that want to testify.
I think in the interest of time, we can go ahead and go to the testifiers. I do have one testifier who'd intended to be here who's not able to be here, Richard Carter. I do have his testimony, and the pages, I believe, are passing out that testimony. We can wait and see what kind of time we have. If we have time, I'd be happy to read the testimony for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there's no motion at this time. It's just an informational hearing.
That's correct.
There's no motion to bring it before us or anything like that.
Well, it was laid over... earlier, and it would be my intent just to lay it over again. So,
but does that mean that it's before us to make amendments and those kinds of things, or was it informational, or removing it from?
It was not my intent to move it.
Okay. So it's informational hearing.
It is.
I just didn't know if there was an official motion to bring the bill before us, or if there had been one in the previous committee. So motions were... Is there going to be any amendments to the bill that you know of?
Not that I'm aware of, Representative. Okay.
But we don't... Was there a motion to bring it before us in the last committee?
Mr. Pomeroy... Yes, and then in the notes, it is clear that the bill was moved before us in the last
and the motion
in the last
was
committee, and then it was just moved to be before us, and then it was laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There's no motion to move it further, and it's not my intention.
But it is before us officially.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Bly, I think first on our list is Mr. Mashad.
Yes, I believe so.
Mr. Mashad, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Mike Mashad, and I am here in instead of Mr. George Crocker from the North American Water Office. So I'm here to help speak his support for this bill. When I'm not here in front of you folks, I am currently working for Dual Wind, a seabed wind development company based out of Woodstock, Minnesota. I do have a handout here today. I am going to present the issues in this bill from a kind of a broader perspective and help frame what a feed-in tariff can do here. And the handout I'm passing out kind of sets this up in terms of the evolution that's going on in the electric grid today. And I've titled this Electric Grid Modernization. Is it going to be orderly or chaos? And there is change happening in the grid today. And the generation technology is evolving, and the trend it's evolving in is in a manner where smaller sized plants are becoming ever more cost effective. And this trend is an irreversible trend in innovation of generation technology. And we're seeing more and more deployment of distributed power plants rather than the old paradigm of larger central station plants that we've seen for decades. And I want to point out that this shift is a more fundamental kind of a shift than the transition that's going on from fossil fuels to renewable energy fuels. And this trend towards smaller, cost-effective plants is across all the different generating technologies that we have available today. So this trend towards smaller dispersed systems is irrespective of whether or not it's renewable or conventional fueled facilities. So a framework is going to be necessary for organizing this transition if we're going to have the grid evolve in a manner that's consistent with our broader public policy objectives. And a feed-in tariff is an effective vehicle for stimulating the desired type of generation development. It has been applied with great success in other parts of the world. Germany stands out in particular. California is now beginning to implement one. And so it's been known to work, and if you just got to get it right in order to get it to be effective and stimulate the types of development that we want. And there are some characteristics about this dispersed and distributed development that are not immediately obvious to an individual installation. When you start looking at the impact of aggregates of this kind of technology on the grid, you see some very interesting impacts that are more than, or how should I say it, greater than the sum of the parts. One example of that is when you have intermittent wind systems that are dispersed around in different geographic areas. The wind is blowing in one place when it's not blowing in another, and the aggregate result is that you can end up with a firmer capacity value of the group of generators as a whole, and there's a net grid benefit to the total sum from dispersing these plants out in smaller areas. Another example is the effect that photovoltaic systems produce collectively during the peak hours when the sun is shining, and it tends to reduce the need to run expensive fossil fuel power plants. There's another factor in this equation that comes in when you start adding storage systems and demand-side strategies. Coupled with these distributed sources, and these things in combination can result in a reduction in the need to build base load power plants. So the combination of reducing demand and or supplying the system from the supply side generation source can in effect level out and firm up the system needs to the point where you can impact the need for baseloads. Lay on top of this the development of internet-based control systems like the smart grid that add instantaneous power flow capabilities. You can end up reducing the peak demand on individual transmission lines and thus avoid the need to build additional power lines as well. And by no means the least synergistic attribute of these systems comes from local ownership of these systems and the economic development benefits that accrue with the cash flow staying in the local community. And these are enabled in the areas where we need it most, in the rural parts of the state, and where the dispersal can provide us with the best system benefits, as I mentioned, such as the advantage that comes from dispersed deployment of wind systems. In my handout, I've got a second page that just kind of shows the distinction between today's central utility and tomorrow's distributed utility. and it kind of gives you a pictorial vision of where things are going in the development of the grid. You can see there's all kinds of technologies, fuel cells, PV, storage batteries. This picture doesn't show it, but plug-in electric hybrids are coming along, and they're also going to be a key component in managing the grid, because you can either use them to store energy from the grid or supply energy to the grid. And the third sheet in my presentation shows the operating of this new system, where we've overlain the intelligence factor that comes along with the control system, where the whole system gets smart by integrating the and optimizing these technologies. Now, this bill will end up being used primarily by these smaller systems, primarily because it has an exclusion in there or a reduction in there for taking advantage of other federal credits that are now available. The larger plants will definitely be able to take advantage of those larger federal credits, and so the feed-in tariff here will help stimulate the development of these smaller systems. Smaller systems have been disadvantaged because they cannot negotiate a market price like the big projects can. And because we haven't had effectively a level playing field for these smaller systems, we haven't seen a lot of deployment at this time in the state of Minnesota in the smaller systems. The existing tariff prices are inadequate to support the development. The seabed contract, as the larger projects do, does give a negotiating ability to get a price that's fair and reasonable. And as I said, these smaller systems can't do that. I just want to mention briefly that the strengthening the interconnection authority that is in this bill is a key attribute here. And because of the large backlog in the MISO system and their queue, to the extent that we can interconnect resources to state authority, we can do so. It'll only accelerate our achieving our renewable energy standard goals. And enabling the deployment of these smaller systems now will set the stage for those smart grid technologies as they also co-develop, so that we can get an even bigger bang for our buck when the smart grid technologies actually get in service. And one last comment about the bill itself, too. There's a tiered pricing structure in there for wind energy systems, and I think this is a necessary strategy that will equalize the development of these wind systems geographically in all regions of the state. It will essentially levelize the development field between windy regions and non-windy regions by setting a similar financial payback for projects that neutralizes and affects the wind resource. And with that, I will just stop and be willing to take questions, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions for Mr. Michaud? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I came in late. I don't recall you hearing your name. Can you tell me, question I've always wanted to know about, because I have an expert here, how much electricity is produced from solar at dusk, from dusk to dawn?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
Mr. Minister,
obviously if the sun isn't shining, there's no production directly from a solar panel. However, the stuff it does produce during the daytime hours is even more valuable, because it is precisely during the daytime peak hours when the electricity costs the most.
Yep. Representative Gunther, I can tell you from my experience with a 3-kilowatt solar array that if you have full sun, it produces pretty much at its capacity. My array actually is rated at 2.88 kilowatts, and in a typical day like today, it would from 9 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock in the evening be producing roughly 2.6 kilowatts consistently.
Mr. Chairman, you hear over and over that we have to use electricity smarter, and they do things like laundry and stuff like that when we aren't at peak time. That would all kind of go by the board, just kind of so that we have to rely on peak generation or base generation. Is that right?
Representative Gunther, it's my understanding, and we'll hear from some people from the utilities that can talk about this in a few minutes, but I believe that we have kind of the opposite situation with solar that we do with wind, and what solar generally is producing electricity at the periods that, particularly in the summer, that are periods of peak usage. So it does correspond with the peak rather than occur when the demand is low.
Absolutely, sir.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Further questions for this witness? Seeing none, Mr. Michaud, thank you. Next on the list, we have John Curry. Curry here.
It's coming.
After that, we have Mr. Skarbaka from Great River, followed by Lee Sundberg, Betsy Engel King, and Lisa Daniels. So give you a heads up so we don't have to take quite so much time from one witness to the next. Mr. Curry, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty, and thank you, members of the committee. I'm John Curry. I'm with the National Audubon Society, Minnesota chapter, and I just have a few brief comments about this. For those of you who have not had Audubon before, you should know that we are 17,000 members in the state, representing 14 chapters from Agassiz in the northeast to Zumbro Valley, in the northwest to Zumbro Valley in the southeast. And we want to thank Representative Bly for bringing this very important issue, this very important concept forward. Audubon has been devoted to bird conservation since 1905, and we are traditionally involved in habitat and wildlife projects, much less so energy initiatives. But over the course of the past 10, 20 years, it's become obvious to our scientists that the number one threat to birds in North America is global climate change. And so we've become more and more involved in these issues. And our executive director, John Flicker, nationally, is convinced that feed-in tariffs is the best tool that we have to promote a clean energy future. I want folks to know that for the past 40 years, we've been collecting and synthesizing Christmas bird count data. That means thousands of our volunteers go out over the Christmas holiday, and we try to determine through audio signals and visual sightings what birds are out there. And when those data are aggregated, we can find the center of abundance of a species. And this spring, we came out with a report, spring of 2009, that showed the average bird species in North America has moved 40 miles north its winter habitat over the past 40 years. And if these trends continue, it represents a real major ecological disruption. So in Minnesota now, there are species like the boreal chickadee, the Bohemian waxwing, the three-toed woodpecker that have all moved out of the state. And that represents population shifts of 279 miles, 111 miles, and 203 miles, respectively. So because of this Audubon, and it corresponds directly to the warmer winters that we're having over the past 40 years, Audubon has looked at the feed-in tariffs, and we are convinced through our partners in Europe and elsewhere that they are a tool that's going to get us to where we're going much more fastly than the current incentives that Minnesota is approaching. We look at Germany, which you've heard a lot about, and I've not heard this figure bantered about, but Germany now produces 55% of the world's solar energy.
They just passed their feed-in tariff law in 2004. It shows you how effective it can be. And if you think of Germany, folks, they actually have less solar capacity than the state of Minnesota. So this is something you can do and have an enormous impact in the future. I also want you to think about just in terms of economic incentives that are out there, and I'll give you a good example. Audubon, Minnesota sponsors 20 charter schools. We're involved in the environmental curriculum and the management of those schools. All of those schools have a great incentive to buy green energy off the grid through many of the various programs that Xcel and others offer. If they want to incorporate this into their learning environment for the children, it will cost them money. Under the feed-in tariff paradigm, they could do the same thing, but they would make money and they would produce renewable energy to give back to the grid. I'm convinced that in the next 3 or 4 years, I could talk to those 20 Audubon schools over and over and over, and they would not have the financial resources to invest in the current renewable energy paradigm. But if this bill were passed, they would, I'm convinced, all 20 of them, make the investments needed to do a renewable energy in the future and contribute back to the grid. I think I'll conclude my comments with that. If there's questions, I'm available. Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerr, you used the word climate change when you opened your comments. What kind of climate change are you worried about?
Mr. Curry.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, I think climate change represents a broad spectrum of issues. It's not a one-way pattern where we're seeing increasing temperatures in each microclimate. Birds are specialists, birds are generalists, and they respond to all of the changes that are going on. We see that global climate change, primarily a global warming phenomenon, is shifting about two-thirds of the birds to a northern climate, many of them away from the oceans, and inward migration is also happening, and about a third of the birds are shifting south. So I talked about the 40 miles north figure. That's aggregating the southern shift, the northern shift, and the inward shift. Trying to dumb it down for a simple presentation.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard.
Thank you. Yeah, you used the word climate change, and it sounds like wiggle words to me when for the last 15 years it's been global warming that people have been in a panic about. I'm noticing the wildlife around my house seems to respond a lot more healthily and with more vitality when the winters aren't as hard as they have been for the last winter or two, or like they were back in the 70s. When we saw little critters like starving to death and things like that. But let's assume for a moment that you could set the world wildlife pattern. Now, let's just restrict ourselves to Minnesota. Suppose you were the king of the Audubon world and you could set bird migration patterns or living habitats or their range anywhere you'd want. At what time in the history of the world would you consider ideal? Where would you set that? What snapshot in time would meet your approval?
Mr. Curry.
Representative Hilty, Representative Beard. There were relatively stable bird center of abundance patterns up until about 40 years ago. I appreciate being made king because I would set the bird population standards right at what was about standard. But you're absolutely right. Wildlife is all about shifting patterns. There are patterns that are consistent over time, but there's nothing consistent from year to year, which is why we tried to present something like a 40-year aggregation of data. And I don't pick my words, whether it's global warming or climate change or any of the other things that our focus group tested. That's just what comes to my lips. And birds do not tend to have a political perspective or agenda. So we're bringing the data to you, and you guys can do with it what you will. We believe that these energy policies make a lot of sense, and they will benefit wildlife and human populations.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad just to be able to flesh this out a little bit. There's a lot more we could talk about there with birds that used to live here before the last ice age, for instance, some of the other four-legged creatures that used to run around this place that don't, things that may in the future. And frankly, the friends in my neighborhood that watch birds get pretty excited when they see a bird that they used to see in Iowa, and now they're in Minnesota. Most of us consider that a kind of a cool thing and not something to be alarmed about. But I'll conclude my questions with just that comment.
Thank you.
Representative Knuth.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Curry, and I don't want to turn this into a global warming debate, but my question about bird shifting and putting this into ecology and, bird shifting ranges may or may not correspond to shifts in patterns of invertebrates or other things in the ecology. I'm assuming the Audubon Society is also recognizing that, and this is very little to do with, well, it has a lot to do with why we support a feed-in tariff. Some of us, but I'm assuming that the Audubon Society doesn't think of birds only in a single category. They're looking at their habitat, their ecology, their food sources, their ability to reproduce because of those food sources, all of those sorts of things, and those are related to climate change as well. And so I'm just, it's more than a single bird, but I think that is one yet another piece of evidence, and one that I think a lot of people are concerned about in terms of the way our climate is shifting and has been disrupted.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. Mr. Curry, if I could respond to that, I think that people respond to information in different ways, and there are some folks who like to hear about ice core samples in Greenland, for example. And as other folks, I'm a little more like this, that respond to changes I see in my own backyard. And I think this is just another piece of the puzzle. All of wildlife is responding. Humans tend to interact with birds as much or more than any other species. And this collection of data is much more comprehensive and ongoing than any other collection of data that's available about wildlife.
Further questions for Mr. Curry?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Scarbacca. Welcome once again to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Glenn Scarbacca. I manage resource planning with Great River Energy. GRE sometimes gets a little overshadowed by our larger neighboring utility, Xcel Energy, but I do want to report that last week, the American Wind Energy Association named GRE the number one wind cooperative in the nation. In other words, GRE has more wind energy on our system than any other co-op in the country. So we're not opposed to renewables at all. We're ahead of our compliance with the renewable energy standard. And in fact, in listening to Mr. Michaud's testimony, this vision of a distributed utility, I think, is something that that could happen over time as technology improves. There's a lot to be said for that. But I think the question here is, how do we get there? Do we let this that sort of a vision evolve organically as the technology develops, as economic conditions permit it to happen, or do we force feed it through an administrative function of setting almost a command and control structure in place to set rates and make it happen earlier than economics would normally let it evolve. So we've got five concerns about the bill. First off, we do not feel it's needed to meet the renewable energy standard. Secondly, the prices that it creates are far above the marketplace for renewables. The third is that it's going to be administratively cumbersome and burdensome to carry out over time. The fourth is that the subsidies that it create inequities amongst ratepayers and our members. And lastly, there are vehicles for small renewables to have support, and in fact, small renewables are happening in the state of Minnesota. I'll try to be very brief in hitting these comments. First off, with respect to, is this necessary to meet the renewable energy standard? I noticed that finding in subdivision 1F of the bill essentially says that this would be required to do that, and I guess we would disagree. First off, as I mentioned, GRE is well ahead in our compliance with renewable energy standards. We're good through at least the year 2013, and so far we've seen no shortages of renewable projects that we could purchase from or develop to continue to meet that requirement. Also, looking at the state of Minnesota as a whole, the American Wind Energy Association, in their 2008 annual wind industry report, which I think came out last week, showed that while Minnesota is ninth in the nation in terms of its wind potential, we're fourth in installed capacity, so we're already developing wind resources well ahead of our native resources, if you will. And we also were named as a state the number one state in the nation in terms of wind penetration, or in other words, the percentage of generation supplied by wind. So we're already doing well as a state in terms of bringing renewables online. The second concern, a concern about the pricing. The pricing is far, the pricing in this bill is far, far above the marketplace for renewables as we see it. It's based on assuring profit for projects rather than on a regime of minimizing costs. We have a concern that by putting high prices in front of interested developers, are we really creating an incentive to compete and innovate, or are we simply throwing out money that will, in fact, discourage innovation and discourage competition? We have some concerns that by setting prices as high as this bill does, that we're displacing potentially lower cost renewables, and really kind of brings to mind, why would we put in our more expensive renewable options early before we've exhausted lower cost options first? One example of that in the bill is in subdivision 11E, there's a requirement that utilities subsidize the cost of interconnections if in fact the development is going into a place where it can't be connected to the distribution system. So in other words, if there's a location that has to connect to transmission, the utility would have to pay the additional cost that might be required to do a transmission interconnection rather than distribution. This is an example, again, of not seeking out the lowest hanging fruit, but in fact putting in place a subsidy. A week ago Monday, you heard some testimony about merit order effect from Professor Kildegard. We don't disagree that there is a merit order effect that comes from adding renewables, but we'd like to point out that that effect occurs for any kind of renewable. It's not anything unique to the feed-in tariff, and in fact, you would get more benefit of the type that Professor Kildegard was testifying about if you put in lower cost renewables rather than higher cost renewables. And with respect to photovoltaics, one of the concerns we have is that photovoltaics, the technology is improving rapidly and the costs appear to be coming down. I've seen some figures, I don't know if they're the best figures out there, that show that by the year 2025, photovoltaics may cost something on the order of one-fourth what they cost today. What that means is that if you force photovoltaics in early, you're going to be paying more for the development of photovoltaics than you would if you simply let them develop organically and took advantage of cost decreases as they occur. Or in other words, the early adopters run a high risk of obsolescence. We're concerned that this structure of fixing prices here in the legislature rather than letting the market set prices is going to be cumbersome administratively and perhaps risky. And I guess the question I have there is, can the legislature respond quickly enough to market changes that are occurring all the time out in the marketplace to avoid unintended consequences? And last year is a really good example of that. For the first 9 months of last year, we saw the prices of virtually everything that goes into generation of all types increasing as commodity prices, fuel prices, what have you, were skyrocketing. Then in the last quarter of the year, of course, we all know that came crashing down. If you're sitting here with prices that are fixed administratively, are really going to be able to respond to those types of market changes? And if we don't, then we run the risk of distortions in the whole chain of supply that goes into adding resources of this type. We have a concern about inequities that get created amongst customers by this bill. I guess the bill talks about just and reasonable rates. We think that what's just and reasonable to the recipients of a subsidy isn't necessarily what's just and reasonable to those who are burdened. And the concern we have here is that for folks who don't have sunny lots or don't have land for windmills, maybe don't own any land at all, They are not going to have the opportunity to participate in the benefits of this legislation, but they're going to pay the costs that come from it to the extent, anyway, that those costs represent a subsidy. The last point I'd like to make is that small renewables are happening in the state. We do have support programs in place, net metering, PURPA, the distributed generation statute, all help to make small renewable projects happen. All of those programs are based on avoided costs rather than fixing costs. And that means that as costs increase in the future, if that is our future, so will the opportunities to benefit from those programs. The last report I saw on small generation coming out of the Department of Commerce was a report for 2006, which showed that without a feed-in tariff, but with these other support programs, there were 233 small generating projects added within the state of Minnesota. About, as I recall, three-quarters of those were wind, but there were photovoltaics represented as well. So I appreciate the opportunity this afternoon to express these concerns. Thanks.
Questions for Mr. Scarbacher. Representative Jackson.
Perhaps a little more of a comment, I think it's rhetorical, but I live in rural Mille Lacs County, and you spoke of allowing the market to grow organically rather than force feed, and yet I wonder if we hadn't taken the bull by the horns in rural Minnesota and force fed it if I'd have electricity today.
Chairman, you did say that was a rhetorical question. Can I leave it at that?
We were hoping for a rhetorical answer. Representative Brainer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scarbacher, you referred to the merit order study that Dr. Kildegard presented to us last week, and you talked about its merits, but also if we had maybe put lower cost alternative energy in, the price might be reduced at a similar or faster rate. But my comment is that what I learned just as a generalist from this merit order study is that the seeming incongruity between offering a higher price over time to the feed-in tariff actually brought down the wholesale price of electricity. And it seems to me that the merit order study addresses some of your concern about the initial subsidizing of the cost of energy, but with the result of actually bringing out about a lower wholesale price. So I'd like you to comment on the end result of the study in relation to your concern about cost.
The bottom line in that study is that if you add renewables, you're taking, which have kind of like a zero operating cost, they have a cost to install, but once they're installed, the operating cost tends to be very low, maybe even zero. And by having those renewables available, you can take offline generation that would be using fuel and would have a higher operating cost. And there's no disagreement about that. But the benefit that you get is achieved better if you put in lower cost renewables than higher cost renewables. There's nothing in, although that study purports to defend the subsidies for renewables that the feed-in tariff provides, the fact of the matter is that you would get more benefit through even that sort of point of view if you could put the renewables in at a lower cost.
Representative Brainer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would you support a feed-in tariff for small wind generators in residential areas? Because that would be a lower cost renewable? I mean, is that, in other words, the solar is the higher cost, obviously. Do you support incentivizing distributed energy at a lower cost if that's possible?
Mr. Scarbacher.
I guess I support the notion of adding renewables at the least possible cost or close to that. In other words, you have to look. I mean, I realize it's more than just simply looking at cost. That there are locational effects have to be taken into place. For example, distributed generation. If you can connect it to the distribution system, you may be able to avoid some infrastructure. You may have some lower losses. And certainly there's some advantages to diversity in supply, so I can recognize all of that. But I guess the concern that I have is that if the subsidy that you're putting in place exceeds the benefits that you are achieving by getting to that end, then I guess that I can't support. Then I think that the question comes back to why don't you do the renewables at the least cost that you can do it on.
Thank you. This distributed generation discussion is one I hope we can engage in a little further, but at some point, doing distributed generation just because we hate big box utility companies can be counterproductive if the distribution, the cost of distributing the generation effort is the least productive and economical option. And remember, this is something I think we're kind of losing sight of here. There's a reason we built very large power plants turning out lots and lots of kilowatt hours. It's because we could do it with a minimum investment, the most effective and efficient use of labor, capital, and land to get that done. And oh, by the way, when it came to cleaning up emissions, it's more efficient to clean up a 1,200 megawatt coal plant than it is to clean up 60-50 megawatt coal plants. Look at China, for instance. In their original build out, they built a whole bunch of these little 50 megawatt stinkers all over the country, frankly, because they didn't have the transmission infrastructure. They were trying to put electricity to the rural countryside, which is a noble effort. But when it came time to clean up the plants, it was hugely expensive to do that. And as their transmission infrastructure developed, they found it much more productive and efficient to invest in very large plants near waterways, for instance, where they could get coal to them. And they could use or put out the maximum output per hour of labor that's put in. And that's something I think we need to consider. Using the existing transmission infrastructures here and putting smaller generation units on those lines near load centers is a marvelous idea if we can do it and still control the productivity of the capital, the land footprint that we need, and the number of man hours or labor hours that it takes to produce the megawatts. One other thing we're running into with this whole idea of the small wind and solar-based voltaic deals is that they're not labor-efficient. They're actually very labor-intensive. So even though the fuel source, sun or wind, might be there, the maintenance cost to keep them running per kilowatt-hour is actually, I think, out of bounds. And I hope one of the electric people will actually have the expertise to talk to that. But that's a big discussion we should have. And it gets down to, when we're talking about assets, we're not just talking about coal and oil and natural gas here. Remember, we're talking about labor. We're talking about land, we're talking about capital, dollars. And in spite of what you see coming out of Washington today, money does not grow on trees. People work hard for it, save it, aggregate it through the capitalist system, buying stock, putting their money together, and building stuff. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to run too far with that, but I think Representative Breinert raised a great issue that we need to talk about. And as we're talking about distributed generation, that would be a marvelous discussion for us to have.
Well, thank you, Representative Beard. I always appreciate your perspective and your comments. And as you know, it has long been my intention that we have this discussion. I hope that we will be able to find some time to continue the discussion in this committee before the end of the session, but certainly with the Legislative Energy Commission, which I'm pleased that you are a member. You're absolutely right. We do need to have this discussion. We need to develop some kind of a vision that makes sense for the future of energy in Minnesota. And that's what we're doing today, and that's why I don't have any intention of trying to move this bill at this point. I think it is simply a focus of discussion that needs to take place. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to bring a little different perspective to the question of cost effectiveness, and I get this question back in my district quite a bit since I have the only wind turbine in my district in my house, and I get asked about well, what'd that thing cost, and how do you afford this? Is it 20 kW Jacobs, and isn't it running you out of house and home and all these things? And I have an editorial coming out in the paper actually fairly quickly back home, and to address some of this, because it's been an issue, and I think a lot of the people in this room are aware of this issue and come talk to me about this issue. But I've got a response, and I think it's some. We talk about economics and cost effectiveness, and up until about a year ago, we were all sailing along pretty well. We could put our money in a CD or somewhere and get 5%, 10%. Some people were doing better than that, 20% maybe on some investments. But what happened? We kind of crashed out here. Well, 5 years ago, I took money out of a 401k and now a 201k and bought a wind turbine. Now, I wish I'd have took everything out of that 401k and bought a wind turbine, because that wind turbine is now worth 50% more than it was when I bought it. That's a 50% return on investment right there. So when you talk about cost effectiveness, you can't just sit here and talk about, well, we went and we invested and we made 10% on this, or that's what I'm planning on doing. You have to figure in these crashes too. And I don't think you're figuring in the crashes into your cost effectiveness equation or calculus. That's the point I want to make. So I wish that I took all my money out of my 401k and bought as many wind turbines and solar panels as I could have. And I think we need to encourage it. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Scarbacca? Representative Bly.
You made the comment if we did have this lower cost renewable energy we could invest in. Do you have any sense of what tools or mechanisms there are to give us that cheaper renewables at the same kind of rate that might the feed-in tariff might do?
Mr. Scarbacca.
Well, I think the I think we need to look hard at the existing programs that are in place for renewables, for starters, because again, Representative Purcell's project didn't have a feed-in tariff, but did prove to be economically beneficial, and that's great. I mean, that's this notion of distributed renewables, distributed generation of any kind can be a great idea if it can stand on its own 2 feet or nearly full.
Or if you have the capital.
Yeah.
Well, we do have other testifiers and some serious time constraints. So, Mr. Scarbacca, thank you. Mr. Sundberg. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Lee Sundberg. I'm with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. I represent the 44 nonprofit member-owned distribution cooperatives and the sixth-generation transmission. I appreciate the work that Representative Bly has done on his bill this year. The number of changes from last year's bill, and I wish it were enough that I could say to support it, but I'm still on the opposed side. The bill requires interconnection to distribution lines. The electric co-ops have 122,000 miles of distribution line. I think that's around 3 to 4 times more than all the other utilities put together. So unless there's some high or a bunch of high-income households installing lots of solar, I think we would see the vast majority of the application, which was the case with the state small power QF PURPA law. We have mentioned a number of times that co-ops are doing very well and will continue to do, I'm sure, in implementing the 25% renewable energy standard, and we're doing so at the lowest possible cost, and I just don't think that the bill in this form is going to make it or help it continue to be lowest cost, but doing just the opposite. I think the rates in the bill are a bit beyond any what we would consider business or make any business or economic sense, much like the co-op grocery store selling a loaf of bread at retail for $3, but being forced to or must buy the bread wholesale at $6. it just doesn't seem to make much sense. And in the case of solar, the wholesale rate at the beginning can be 8 times higher than our retail. So, rather than being forced to enter very uneconomical long-term contracts that seem to intentionally raise rates to our customers, we're trying to find ways not to do that. We're seeing too many other increases already, and we're hearing more and more from our residential customers about affordability, and I'm just not surmising that this will happen with the bill. It is already happening, as I hear it from those who are on the front lines, and this bill would just pile on, using a very unsophisticated econometric model, back of an envelope, by using one of the limitations, which I think is one of the better new aspects of the bill, that 20% of the renewable energy standard, 2012, we would have a 2.4% retail of our retail sales could be feed-in tariff production. That would, using current numbers, 2007 numbers, that would equate out to roughly $160 increase, or a 10% increase in 2012 if we maxed out at the 20% of the renewable energy standard. So, and raising rates like this to, so that a nonprofit electric co-op can guarantee a profit for another business, in our view, just taking the rate making process a bit too far, and the automatic adjustment clause for cost recovery is not an answer for us. This is not a solution for nonprofit co-ops when the issue is just plain cost. And another aspect of the bill that gives us heartburn, as you might know, is anytime we get into PUC rate making, we get heartburn when we have the PUC determining more of our rates than the local member elected board of directors. Another aspect in the bill is that it provides for no double dipping or incentives and subsidies for most wind, but it doesn't, or you can double or double dip for solar. So we have a situation for take a solar under 40 kW. The co-op would pay the average retail energy rate plus then the 65 cents for the first year, and then plus all the other state and federal incentives, exemptions, rebates, and grants. And not only then would our customers be paying 70 cents a kilowatt hour, but then also pay any interconnection cost if it's more than a simple setup to the distribution line. Although we appreciate the proposed limits that are in the bill. I don't know where those limits should be. If I could get beyond the bill's concept, there's an arguable discussion there, I'm sure. And finally, last year I emphasized the very negative rate impact on small co-ops, especially in a small co-op system of 1 to 3 local distribution co-ops and a generation and transmission co-op. The rate increase would be spread among few customers. I gave the specific example of Minnesota Valley Co-op in Montevideo. That's the only local distribution co-op served by a generation transmission co-op, and the co-op has 5,300 customers with 1.6 customers per mile of line, and is 30% below the state median income. Now, the equalization section, might be a good attempt to resolve that issue, but I think it still raises the question of rate impacts on individuals. some utilities will pay in after the equalization, pay in even more of a subsidy. Others receive a rebate. But in either case, the individual's monthly bill increases on the date that the bill is paid. The individual isn't, I wouldn't suspect, too concerned about a rebate that the co-op would receive 11 or 23 months later. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you, Mr. Sundberg. Members, since we are already past our regular time for adjournment, I think we can go to 4:30 to give Ms. Engel King a chance to tell us what she had to say today. We have Lisa Daniels on the agenda, but I don't believe that she's present. I don't see her anywhere. Ms. Engel King, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engel King, and I'm Director of Resource Planning for Xcel Energy. I understand my time is short here, so I'm just going to try to hit my main points. I think you've heard a lot about the bill. I think today we moved a little more toward the concept, which is maybe what we really need to be talking about. And so I think the first thing I need to say about this concept is that it's a solution looking for a problem. Minnesota has chosen a path to expand renewables, and it's a renewable energy standard. And unless you are willing to repeal that renewable energy standard, there is no room for a global feed-in tariff. Now, there may be room for something that's more targeted. If there's something particular that you want to split out, you know, there may be room for that, and we can talk about that. But the problem with the two is that they are the exact opposite of each other. When you do a renewable energy standard, you are determining a fixed quantity, and you're allowing the price to vary according to how much it takes, how much it costs to fill that quantity. When you do a feed-in tariff, you're setting a fixed price, and you're allowing the quantity to self-select. So ideally, you're setting a price that is high enough to maybe get the quantity that you want. If you combine the two, you have established a fixed price and a fixed quantity, and it's almost guaranteed to cost everybody more than either policy on its own should. So I wanted to just start with that statement. The second thing I wanted to say is that the feed-in tariff is really addressing a market failure that doesn't exist in Minnesota. You've heard over and over that it's wildly successful in Europe. The reason that it's wildly successful in Europe is because Europe has a pure market for electricity. All electricity has to bid into the market, and all electricity has to purchase out of the market. So higher cost resources like wind and solar, where we're combining fixed costs with variable costs and pricing them much higher, are not selected in the market, and they have to rely on a separate REC market to be selected. When in Minnesota, we purchase renewables through long-term contracts at fixed or established prices or set escalated prices, we are removing that market failure. We already guarantee a revenue stream for our developers to develop their wind projects and to do so in a manner that will allow them to finance the project. And in fact, I would argue with you that it's probably the safest revenue stream around, because the legislature has guaranteed that a utility will recover it from their customers and recover it on a real-time basis. Any developer can take that contract into a bank and say, finance this, Xcel Energy, and the state legislature is backing it 100%. The final thing that I want to say that I think the advantage of the RES is it allows us to competitively solicit the wind that we need to fill out our RES, and that keeps our prices low. And I think you've heard quite a bit about the prices are quite a bit higher in this bill than what we've actually seen in the market, and I can provide more information on that if any of you are looking for it. I'm not going to provide it right now. The other things that I would like to address quickly, and then I'm happy to answer questions if there's time. First off, you heard from Mr. Farrell last week that this policy, this bill, would cost residential customers 32 cents a month. And, you know, obviously it's a game everybody plays. You know, they say 32 cents a month, and we multiply it all out, and we say it's millions of dollars. But I actually decided to sit down and do the math and find out what 32 cents a month would buy a customer under this bill. 32 cents a month, if we're assuming that we're going to buy rooftop solar under this bill, mid-sized rooftop solar, so the feed-in price is 62 cents a kilowatt hour. For 32 cents a month, a residential ratepayer would pay $3.84 a year, and at 62 cents a kilowatt hour, it would buy them 6.2 kilowatt hours of solar per year. If we multiply that times Xcel Energy's 1.1 million residential customers, that will purchase approximately 6,820,000 kilowatt hours of solar energy in a year. That equates, when I assume a capacity factor of solar for about 15%, it equates to about 5 megawatts of solar energy, and it would fulfill in 2020 0.04% of our renewable energy standards of 30% of our retail sales. 32 cents a year sounds like a pretty low number if you're really thinking about incenting a lot of solar. I think it's going to cost customers much more. Now, obviously, there's another side of the story. 66% of our revenues come from our commercial customers, and our commercial customers will be paying for this too, and they will be paying much, much more than our residential customers. So I seriously want you to think about cost, particularly when 62 cents a year or 62 cents a kilowatt hour is roughly double what we believe that we can achieve in the market for rooftop solar. The final thing I want to address is this issue of MISO dispatch order, because I think there's been a lot of confusion about it. As Professor Kildegard discussed, certainly if we assume away all capital costs, wind and solar are very, very low cost. But somebody has to pay those capital costs. I mean, coal is first and nuclear is first in our dispatch order too. But that's because we built huge plants that we're recovering through base rates to provide them. MISO has already come up with a solution for the dispatch order model. What they have said is that wind always gets dispatched and it's always a price taker in the market. And the developers are paid their long-term fixed price by the utility that they contract with. So even if they're dispatched into a market with a negative price, and sometimes we do have markets with a negative price for energy, particularly in very low load hours of the year, they dispatch their wind and they get paid whatever price they've agreed from their developer to pay. So dispatch order is not an issue in Minnesota if you're concerned about it, and you will not have the same effect that Dr. Kildegard testified to about overall lowering of the wholesale price with respect to dispatch order. So those are the main points I wanted to make. Obviously, I have a lot more I can talk about on this issue. I'd love to come talk to you about it someday, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Engelking, thank you, and we will probably ask you to come back and do that. Members, Mr. Pomeroy has reminded me there's a DFL caucus scheduled in this room for 4:30, so we have to give Paige's time to get things cleaned out, and I'm sorry, but we are adjourned.